Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everybody. Michael Steele here. Great conversation with the author of the new book, Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, none other than Brian Klaas. You can follow him on Twitter at Brian Klaas. That's K-L-A-A-S. And so, Brian, I wanted to get into, I got to pull it up real fast because I loved this this part of the book. It was the chapter 6, Bad Systems or Bad People. And you start off with the great question. It was the best way you could tease the opening here. You go, what can you learn about humanity by watching how people behave while sipping coffee at Starbucks? In fact, turns out quite a bit. Tell us about that experiment, which really, I thought it was almost like the Good Samaritan experiment, but on a much grander scale, that really kind of put a finger on a lot of the cultural and other indicators of how we wind up, the leaders we end up with.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I found these studies fascinating. And basically what it comes down to is something called Rice theory. So Rice theory is this idea that if you come from a community that cultivates rice, then you are more likely to be communitarian and sort of, you know, rely on your neighbors, because you can't have a successful rice crop unless you coordinate with all the people around you. You can't make it in on your own. Whereas if you're from an area that cultivates wheat, you're more likely to be individualistic. Now, that's because wheat can be made on your own. You don't have to care about what anyone else is doing. This sounds like a lunatic theory, right? I mean, it sounds completely crazy. But they looked at this in China, and China, you know, you can look at the same, it's the same country and, you know, thousands of years of history, but there are certain sections of China that are wheat producing, certain sections that are rice producing.
Right.
And what they found is that when they did a series of studies, one of them was at Starbucks, and they looked at, okay, how many people sit alone at Starbucks, or are you constantly with your friends? And also another thing about this is they would set up this chair in the aisle at Starbucks. Yeah. All this is in China.
Right.
And they'd check whether people would move around the chair because it's blocking their way, or whether they pick up the chair and put it back. And these examples are things that reflect individualism versus sort of a more collectivist or communitarian mindset, because people who move the chair, they're more individualistic. People who move around it are more communitarian. Right. And the same for solo sippers at Starbucks versus people who go to Starbucks with their friends. It reflects these divides. And sure enough, the divides were very, very strong in terms of these backgrounds in the different regions of China. And of course, if you run these studies in the United States, you get totally different responses. It's the same sort of thing. It's a much more individualistic culture. So there's a lot more solo sippers and a lot more people moving the chair. Now, what I try to do with this knowledge is I say, okay, there's a lot of stuff that affects our behavior, right? We behave the way we do for a lot of reasons, but surely the systems we come from matter a ton. If even the cultivation of crops in our area affects our behavior, then surely, you know, the corporate culture, the political culture is going to do more of a more of an effect on us than other things. So one of the areas I love in this book is the weirdest thing I did probably was I flew out to Vermont, where Paul Bremer lives. He's you know, the guy who ran Iraq in 2003. He's now a ski instructor in Vermont. And I took a ski lesson with him. And what I found interesting about Paul Bremer is that, you know, whatever you think of him, whatever you think of his record on Iraq, he had served with distinction when he was an ambassador to Norway and some other places. Mm-hmm. And then he gets to Iraq, and one of the first meetings he holds, he asks the question, can we shoot the looters? Can we shoot the people who are stealing TVs and so on and ransacking Baghdad? Now, I mean, if he had suggested that as the ambassador of Norway, he would have been recalled immediately, right? I mean, that's the end of it. And the point I try to make with him is, okay, so he ends up in Iraq. He's getting, you know, he's getting bombed with mortar fire from Al-Qaeda, you know, offshoots and all these people affiliated with Saddam's regime. He's got a bounty of 10,000 grams of gold on his head by Osama bin Laden, which I think is a distinction unique to him as a Vermont ski instructor. But it's one of these things where you think, okay, he's in this horrible situation, this horrible system. He has to make very different calculations than he did when he was the ambassador to Norway. And then he comes back to the United States. I mean, the first thing he said to me when we're on the chairlift in this Vermont ski resort was, we got stuck underneath the sort of chairlift tower. And he says, whenever I'm teaching kids, you know, I tell them it's lucky to get stuck here and they need to make a wish and then it will come true. And I'm like, this is not what I expected. You know what I mean? Like, and I think the point is that we're much more chameleon-like than we like to believe. We morph depending on the systems that we live in. And I think that actually is quite hopeful, because it means, you know, it's much easier to change systems than it is to change people. So in a way, that gives us our political project and our political homework to do.
Yeah, it does in a lot of ways. But I still come back to the point that, and it really kind of, I guess in one sense, you confirmed for me an idea that I put out there, that when I look at our economy, our healthcare, and you know, our race relations, and all of these other systems that are out there, and then I look at our politics. In the past, you know, you can make the case that all of those systems and the policies that sort of roils within them sort of dictated the political engagement, dictated the politics. The politics was a reflection of, you know, our desire to have better healthcare, or our desire to have lower taxes, or our desire to feed more people, whatever it happens to be. Today, we seemingly are in a position where our politics is dictating the outcomes of those particular systems. So the systems are no longer driving the politics are driving the systems itself. So we're more tribal, we're much more insular, we look suspiciously at each other. We've got political leaders like Representative Gosar, you know, threatening to kill other members via cartoons. And you've got, you know, other members, you know, on the left who are threatening their fellow members if they don't support a grand spending plan. So you have all of these threats and this tension that's sort of blowing out of our political system. And I use the term infecting all these other important systems that really can't afford to be infected. Do you kind of see it that way? Is that a good way to look at this? Or am I looking at it a little bit skewed?
No, I think you're right. And I think this connects to something that you said earlier about how it's sort of a reflection of us sometimes too, and what's being demanded, that we're sort of in exactly the place that we want to be. I mean, at least not that we want to be, but that's a certain segment of the population wants us to be in. You know, I think the thing with Gosar, for example, or some of the vitriol that exists in politics, is it conditions the future leaders to behave in the same way. You know, I think that's why accountability is so important. I have one of the chapters that I have later on in the book is about how, you know, accountability really does matter. Oversight really does matter. It affects people's behavior. And I think when you see Gosar behave the way he did, I mean, he shared a video of him murdering somebody, right? And like any other job in America, he'd be fired for that.
Right.
And yet, you know, it's like we've set the bar lower in Congress than we have in corporate America over and over and over again. And well, what's that going to do? It's going to mean that there's going to be more people who behave like them, especially because the Republican base rewards it, right? I mean, one of the things that I think is really difficult, especially in places where it's a solid, solid, deep red district, let's say, you know, in the rural South,
right,
is that to differentiate yourself, you have to be more Trump-like, you have to be more Gosar-like. And there's no consequences to doing that. So it's an interaction between the sort of elite accountability and the demand from the base. And I think that's what's happening in the Republican Party right now, is that the elite accountability has disappeared. I mean, there's no shame, there's no consequences. When people used to sort of say, you know, I also think this is partly because of, and this is something I don't talk about in the book, but I think it's also partly because of the breakdown of party control to an extent. I mean, in the past, you wanted to go on Fox News, you're gonna have to play by the rules of, you know, the Mitch McConnell of the day or whatever. Now everybody has their own Twitter feed, and they can just sort of, you know, Lauren Boebert, who would be, you know, 25 years ago, she would have been a nobody hoping to rise up the ladder over two decades. You know, now she's broken out because she's become more extreme than the party, and that attracts a certain type of person to her political right. base. So, you know, it's the breakdown of sort of the accountability structure at the top, and then also the demand from the bottom that's always looking for the shock, the sort of extreme, and also, you know, I think, frankly, the entertainment. I mean, I think one of the things that really is a shame.
It.
And that's why when you say the P.T. Barnum, I think you're totally right, because politics has become about entertainment in the United States. And I think that's something where we really have to think long and hard about whether we want that kind of system where the real payoff is that we get amused rather than get problems solved.
Well, a couple of things. One, on the first point that you, on the point you just made about the entertainment, there was, going back to the mid-90s, early 2000, a growing sense among the political class here in Washington. And I'm pretty astute and sort of keyed into those folks as I grew up here. This is my home. I grew up here. Mm. And so, you know, as a native Washingtonian, politics is in the blood, and you know how it ebbs and flows. And during that period, there was a growing concern about it. You can almost pinpoint the switch where, you know, we have the Washington Correspondents' Dinner, which is the big correspondents, you know, Washington correspondents, White House correspondents, journalists in town have this evening where the politicians and the journalists kind of get in a room and have fun and make fun of each other. Well, then they got to the point where, you know, folks were inviting folks out of Hollywood to come to the dinner. And it became, over time, this sort of star-studded affair, which was like, almost like a mini Oscar night in terms of the anticipation, and you could see how people dressed up and how they behaved. And it grew to a point where the dinner had become much more about the who's who from Hollywood and theater and television that would show up, and journalists wanting to be seen with them and photograph with them and do the walk, you know, like the walk where you come in and they take photos of you and so forth, more so than what it was intended to be about was journalism. Mm. And in an ironic way, Trump broke that because he didn't want to play, because he didn't want to be the subject of ridicule, which, you know, likely would have been the case, having been the subject of that at one of, I think, Obama's last, or next to last correspondence dinner. So, and at that moment, it sort of broke that mindset where they said, now we can take this opportunity to focus in on what we originally were about. This was not about going Hollywood. And so you see that kind of spill into our politics, where a lot of politicians now want the likes, want the glamour that comes from appearing on all these talk shows and you know, having people recognize them in restaurants and applaud them when they walk in a room and all this other crazy. And it's really kind of worn down the responsibility that they have as leaders, which then leads to the second part, the accountability that you touched on. How do you then, when you look at something like the January 6th Commission, even in that instance, in the face of an attempted overthrow of our government, no one wants to be accountable.
Yeah.
I mean, I let me rephrase that. It's not no one wants to be accountable. You have efforts by some to avoid accountability. How does that work in the context of this corrupting process that you tap into?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. This is a central aspect. Accountability is so important. And this is an area I talk about in the book. The one, again, it's a study I love. It's about parking tickets in New York City, but it has lessons for January 6th.
Yes, go there.
So basically, up until the early 2000s, diplomats who worked for the United Nations had absolute immunity from parking fines because they were, you know, they had diplomatic immunity. So they could park wherever they wanted to. They might get their cars towed, but they didn't have to pay for anything.
Right.
And eventually, Bloomberg finally said, no, this is crazy. There's 150,000 unpaid parking tickets from diplomats at the United Nations. They owe us like $20 million. We're going to start enforcement. What was really interesting is when you started, right, at the beginning of this period, the Norwegians, the Danish, the Brits, they parked normally, right? They followed the rules. Whereas, you know, the Egyptians, the Pakistanis, a few of these more corrupt countries had a lot of parking tickets. And as soon as the enforcement period happened, all of a sudden, almost overnight, the Egyptians parked like the Norwegians. They just stopped. It just completely cleaned up the act. But the really interesting thing is, before the enforcement period, before there was actually any sort of fines to be paid, the Norwegians who were in New York longest parked illegally the most. So in other words, as they got away with it more, they started to say, you know what, I think I can test the rules a bit, you know?
All right.
So it's a perfect little experiment where it shows when you get away with stuff, you get worse. And when you get caught and you get punished, you get better. I mean, we know this intuitively, but there's a lot of evidence this is true. And so with January 6th, I mean, the point that I always make is you rightly describe it as an attempted overthrow of the government. I mean, if you don't punish that, what's going to happen next time? You know, I mean, I think that's the real problem, is that there's going to be a more sophisticated attempt sometime in the future, and people are not going to have got the message. This is something really, really serious.
Well, there is method to the madness of what Voltaire said, and you noted in chapter 12 of the book, where he said, if God didn't exist, we would have to invent him. And that's how you introduce us to the idea of lesson seven, as you called it. Watched people are nice people. And it really is, you know, when, if you want to alter behavior, then you have to put in place accountability. And that takes a myriad of forms, but it's important nonetheless that those, that, that accountability be there. So if you're going to park illegally, we're going to hold you accountable, meaning you're going to pay the fine. If you are going to engage in a certain type of behavior, we're going to hold you accountable because we're going to watch that behavior. We're going to watch for that behavior.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us, the way Americans do, on a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.